The next case for oral argument is Trostel & Sons Company against Knotts. Mr. O'Neill.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Matt O'Neill representing Mr. Edward Knotts. Two legal principles underlie Mr. Knotts' first challenge to the district court's decision in this matter, based upon the forum selection agreement represented by Wisconsin Statute 180.1330, sub 2. The first is that when corporations decide where to incorporate, they agree to incorporate that state's law into a contract that they hold with their shareholders.
Is there any actual contract that has this forum selection feature? That is, do the articles of incorporation of Trostel & Sons have this forum selection feature?
They do not. The articles themselves simply reference that they are guided by Wisconsin law.
All right. So your argument is that state law forms a contract with the corporation. This is, of course, a very old line. It's the holding of the Dartmouth College case, and I'm shocked that nobody cites Dartmouth College here. But Dartmouth College hasn't been effective in any state of the union for 150 years because every state then amended its corporate code to include a reservation of right to change the law, which, of course, you can't do for a real contract. Is there such a clause in Wisconsin?
A reservation to change the law?
A reservation of rights clause.
I believe there is.
Right. Well, that's what happened after Dartmouth College. So you're making the Dartmouth College argument without considering what states did after Dartmouth College to avoid its holding. Don't you think it would be a little strange for the U.S. Court of Appeals not to notice the last 150 years of legal history?
I assume that would be strange, Your Honor. However, the principle does appear to still obtain that the relationship between a corporation and its shareholders is one of contract.
Well, suppose the statute just said that the corporation agrees that the corporation that does business in the state will never remove a case from state court to federal court. Would that fit under your theory?
It would not. Those laws have been held unconstitutional going back to the 19th century in the Witness case. The difference here is this is a situation where the parties are in privity. In those cases, both Witten's and the Morse case and the Donald case, there were laws that were designed to prevent foreign corporations in I believe it was in Morse, it was a foreign insurance company that came to Wisconsin, was forced to agree in advance that it waived its right to remove any case to federal court. There was no privity involved there. That was for any dispute between that foreign company and any Wisconsin resident. The same thing obtained in Donald, where they simply said if a foreign corporation were to remove a case to federal court, that the secretary was required to revoke their license in Wisconsin. So in those cases, what's missing is the element of privity between the corporation and its shareholders. Here, the corporation is affirmatively exercising its rights under Wisconsin law, under that contract.
Under your theory, Mr. O'Neill, could Mr. Knotts have removed this case to federal court?
He could not have removed the fair value proceeding once filed by Trostel. Had it been filed in circuit court, he could not remove. He's bound by the same contractual provision.
So why would, if you interpret the statute that way, wouldn't we essentially run into the same problem we had in, let's see, was it Morse? Was it Donald? I guess closer to Morse in agreeing not to remove cases to federal court.
I don't think you would, Your Honor, and this is solely because of the contractual nature of the relationship between a corporation on the one hand and its shareholders on the other. Here, when Albert Trostel & Sons decided to go forward with a short-form merger and force Mr. Knotts to divest himself of stock that had been in his family for 150 years, they sent him an informational statement in April of 2007. saying, here is the plan of merger, and here, by the way, are your rights. They're required to do that. Attached as Appendix G to that submission to Mr. Notes was a copy of the Wisconsin statutes, which plainly indicated that if it got to the point where there was no agreement on fair value, that special proceeding would be commenced in the circuit court where the corporation was located. By so doing, they were reaffirming in their contractual relationship with Mr. Notes that what would happen is that that proceeding would be brought in circuit court.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. O'Neill. I guess it was more than just a coincidence that these cases from the 19th century all involve Wisconsin statutes. I'm assuming that the Wisconsin legislature has more recently overcome its ancient hostility to the federal courts. In the trucking components case, we, and in I think the TBK case, the Southern District of New York, treated similar laws that said absolutely nothing about federal courts as not barring federal jurisdiction, as simply dealing with intrastate venue issues in order to avoid these supremacy clause problems that your interpretation of the statute creates. Could you address trucking components and TBK?
I can. In trucking components, the question dealt with, at the end of the court's analysis, they determined that the former president was entitled to indemnification for his legal expenses. And objection was then raised by the opposing side that if you are to make that determination, that is subject to Delaware law that preserved exclusively to the Chancery Courts of Delaware issues of indemnification, corporate indemnification. And what this court said is, number one, this court did not view the Delaware statute as talking about excluding federal jurisdiction, but rather was specifying that it was the courts of chancery versus the courts of law. And the court went on to say, we don't presume for a second that Delaware intended to deprive us of jurisdiction.
Right, and so why doesn't the same analysis apply here? We don't have the Wisconsin legislature saying federal courts stay out any more than the Delaware courts were in trucking components.
We don't, and there's no suggestion by Mr. Notes or by Albert Trostel and Sons that the Wisconsin legislature in this venue provision intended to preclude federal court jurisdiction. The goal of the statute was to make sure that all fair value determinations involving all shareholders of the company were decided in a single venue. Enforcing that as a contractual matter has the benefit of ensuring that all fair value proceedings are known by all shareholders that where they're going to take place. It's just Mr. Notes happened to be an Illinois resident. Had there been another shareholder, dissenting shareholders of Wisconsin resident, it would have been in the circuit court. If it's contractually binding on both sides, then all fair value proceedings will be in state circuit court.
I guess I'm missing your point here. Why is the analysis applied in trucking components and in TBK, namely, in the absence of clear legislative intent to exclude the possibility of federal jurisdiction? We will interpret these statutes as permitting federal jurisdiction.
Well, let me back up. There is an intent in the Wisconsin statute that the proceeding in circuit court is plenary and exclusive. In trucking components, in trucking components, what the court said is they did not construe in the first instance Delaware law as attempting or intending to exclude federal court jurisdiction, but only to delineate between the courts of chancery on the one hand and the courts of law on the other. And so the court didn't need to go any further or consider the impact of the contractual relationship.
Excuse me, but the Delaware statute said the court of chancery is hereby vested with exclusive jurisdiction to hear all the kinds of matters in question. Does the word plenary make a difference? Is
it
that
doesn't.
Your theory? Okay. So why doesn't that reasoning apply here? I haven't heard an answer yet, frankly.
The answer, Your Honor, is that this court in trucking components did not need to proceed to the step of whether there was a contractual relationship under Delaware law that obtained between the corporation and its shareholders and whether that had an impact on the enforceability of indemnification. And let me back up. There was one more distinction in trucking components, and I apologize. I did not relate it the first time. And that is that the court said in the first instance there wasn't a jurisdictional question presented because it was a CERCLA action that brought the case to federal court, not diversity. And this was simply a claim that was brought up in the by the former president, I believe, as a counterclaim. And so there were two steps removed that the court didn't need to reach this issue. Now, I will acknowledge that if the court finds that this contractual relationship between corporation and its shareholders is not binding in these circumstances, and that is Albert Trostel and Sons, on the one hand, can go forward with its short-form merger because it has a right to, but on the other hand, it doesn't need to comply with the provisions of the law and its contract that require it to go forward in circuit court, then we lose. That is the single distinction between this case and the Morris case and the Donald case and the Terrell case, is that they are parties in privity of contract. And the courts from 1972 forward after the Bremen decision have been, as opposed to hostile, they have embraced forum selection clause agreements, have enforced them unless there are reasons to not enforce them, just like any other contractual provision. Fraud, unequal bargaining power, fundamental unfairness. And there's no suggestion here that enforcement of this venue provision, as between these parties, would be the result of any fraud, any unequal bargaining, or would somehow be unfair. The second issue presented on appeal has to do with the scope of the fair value proceeding. Wisconsin law, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court specifically, has addressed once and only once the scope of the fair value proceedings under Section 180.1330, and that is in the HMOW case. The court there made two holdings. The first holding was that there would be no minority discount applied because it's inconsistent with the equitable purpose of dissenters' rights provisions in protecting minority shareholders. And second, the court held that allegations of misconduct such as unfair dealing that are intertwined with the value of the shares subject to the appraisal may in fact be considered by the court in setting fair value. The district court on motions dismissed Mr. Notes' counterclaim that alleged various forms of misconduct that had occurred in the three-year period preceding the merger that Mr. Notes alleged had a direct impact on the fair value of his stock. Mr. Notes contends this was error. In its decision, the HMOW court held that one could proceed. In fact, one must consider all relevant factors to fair value, and one of those relevant factors is prior misconduct that could have had an impact on value. One of the examples that the court gave of misconduct that could be considered was that was considered in the Cavalier Oil case in Delaware.
Let me take one step back about the Wisconsin statute. Is the Wisconsin Corporate Code based on the ABA's Model Business Corporation Act, or is it a non-derived version?
In large part, it is a derived statute.
It's largely derived from the Model Business Corporation Act. So has this question, that implies that a similar clause is in many other states' law, because I think something like 35 states are based on the model. What do we know about how other states have understood this clause?
And are we back on to the first issue, Your Honor?
Right.
I apologize.
Right. Took you back.
What we do know is that in the Virginia District Court, the Virginia District Court construed an almost exact replica of Wisconsin's law as imposing a contractual relationship that was binding on both the corporation and its shareholders, such that when a shareholder attempted to remove a fair value proceeding to federal court, it was remanded because the shareholder had consented in advance that the venue for that proceeding would be in state court. Aside from that decision, Your Honor, I have not seen any courts directly address this particular issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Going back to the second issue regarding the scope of the proceedings, Mr. Notes intended to present at the fair value proceeding evidence about prior misconduct by the company that had an impact on the shares. The alleged prior misconduct involved a usurpation of a corporate opportunity. It was quite similar to the allegation at issue in Cavalier Oil that the Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld as an example of misconduct that could be considered in a fair value proceeding.
So can the fair value proceeding make him better off than he would have been without the merger? Mike, as I understand it, the derivative claims based on the appropriation of the corporate opportunity were handled by the SLC. They said, we don't want to pursue this. So and there was no further relief available there. Are you saying the fair value proceeding provides an opportunity to revisit those issues and make him better off than he would have been without the merger?
I see my light is on. The answer is yes.
Well, as we're talking, you can talk.
The answer is yes, Your Honor. In our view, given the equitable nature of the fair value proceeding, a proceeding that only arises when the shareholder has objected to fundamental corporate change that in past times they could object to and prevent. They had veto power. When they gave that up, the legislature gave an equitable right to receive fair value. And our read of the HMOW decision is that it's not a question of whether Mr. Notes' allegations of misconduct would, outside of the fair value proceeding, be a derivative claim, be a direct claim, be an oppression claim, be any other kind of claim. What it means is, had there been prior misconduct that reduced the fair value of the shares, Mr. Notes is allowed to litigate that as part of that equitable proceeding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Schreiner.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to start, if I may, by touching on something that I have not previously addressed because it was raised in the reply brief, and since there's a lot of money involved, I want to make sure I get my 2 cents worth in on that. The plaintiff's position in this case has been from the beginning that the district court lacked jurisdiction. Indeed, that's the heading of its first argument in its blue brief. We pointed out in our response brief that if that were the case, then the district court surely would not have jurisdiction in order to award the extra $11 million that Mr. Notes thinks he's entitled to by virtue of his argument that they should have been filed in state court, and because it wasn't filed in state court, it wasn't filed within 60 days, and if the company doesn't start the dissenter's rights proceedings within 60 days, then the dissenter is entitled to the full amount that he demanded. And the short answer to that is that beside the oddity of the court lacking jurisdiction and then by the time of the reply brief possessing it, but he shouldn't have exercised it, is that there is a provision in Wisconsin law, perhaps not surprisingly, that tolls the statute of limitations, and this is 60 days it's a very short statute of limitations, but it's a statute, tolls the statute of limitations during the pendency of proceedings in another court and for 30 days after their final disposition. And another provision that says that that applies where the initial action is in federal court. So this is in Section 893, 13, and 15 of the Wisconsin statutes. So it is not by any means a slam dunk if Mr. Notes were to win on the jurisdictional point. Turning to the jurisdictional point, I have to start by saying it's not at all a necessary reading of 180.13.32 that the Wisconsin legislature intended to preclude filing in federal court. Judge Easterbrook, your question, I looked yesterday at the Model Business Corporations Act, which is, of course, the source of this provision, and there is a comment, I think is what it's called, after this provision that says this is a venue provision. And it is a venue provision. The object is clearly that the company bring this in a county, not a particular county. It doesn't say Dane County, for example, as many of our administrative review proceedings had to be brought in the state capital. It says a county, the county where the corporation's principal business is, and that all proceedings have to be there. And that's all it is. There's no hint of an opposition. to a filing in federal court if there is diversity jurisdiction. There is certainly a history going back a long way, even beyond the Morse case, of a certain hostility to federal jurisdiction in Wisconsin. We can go back to Abelman versus Booth and Tarbell's case, where our Supreme Court freed prisoners who were held under federal custody. And in the Abelman versus Booth case, after the U.S. Supreme Court reversed it, ordered its clerk not to accept the mandate from the U.S. Supreme Court. And it is interesting that the
Spencer Roan.
Spencer Roan again. But, you know, there were some egos involved in that. Maybe there were in this one, too. But it isn't just the Morse case. Witten's case, the Donald case, I think the Terrell case are all Wisconsin cases. But I think we've given up on that. We have a Legislative Reference Bureau that reviews statutes. I don't think that that a hostility toward federal jurisdiction. And I thought that
it would be hard to explain this on Wisconsin-specific grounds. If this is a clause in the Model Business Corporation Act,
it would be.
It's very hard to suppose that the Model Business Corporation Act evinces some kind of hostility to federal jurisdiction.
I think you're right, Your Honor. It is even difficult to know from year to year which states are hostile to the supremacy of the federal government, but certainly not all of them or 35 of them. I make this point because I thought for a while that Mr. O'Neill, from an argument that he made in his initial brief, was going to really take on the notion that diversity jurisdiction shouldn't be exercised where the plaintiff is a local resident. Of course, that's been in the statute for, I think, 222 years this month, allowing that. So Trostel had the choice.
Notwithstanding the report of the Federal Court Study Committee.
Notwithstanding the report of the Federal Court Study Committee, the opposition of the ALI, and so on, it's still the law. And I think Wisconsin could not, and I don't think anybody can rationally suggest that it did intend to take that issue on. Judge, I'm going to get just a moment on this the discovery issue, which is the way it came up. Judge Clivert first refused to dismiss the counterclaim based on prior misconduct, the 2004 and 2005 activities of the company in first taking a corporate opportunity, I say the company, the parent company, and first taking a corporate opportunity that belonged to ATS was the argument, and then secondly, buying a subsidiary from ATS. He refused to dismiss it on the pleadings because he said, HMOW says, if it turns out to be closely intertwined with a value or if it leads to questions about the credibility of the company and its value contentions, I should look at it. This actually then came to a head when discovery began, when Mr. Notes scheduled depositions, asked for documents, and Judge Clivert looked at it again, and that is the source of his second decision in which he said, no, this isn't relevant. He fully acknowledges the legitimacy of HMOW, that he's bound by HMOW. He follows it. He says this isn't relevant because Mr. Notes, and it's your question, Judge Hamilton, and Mr. O'Neill, I think, correctly concedes that for his position to prevail, he has to say that that the fair value proceedings would make him better off than he would have been without the merger. He likes to argue about theoretical cases, and Cavalier, the Delaware case that the Wisconsin court referred to in HMOW, was, of course, a case in which there had been concealed bad activity that didn't come out until after the merger, and the Delaware court said very carefully, although under most circumstances we wouldn't look into this, under these circumstances we will. There had actually even been a stipulation in the Cavalier case that the appraisal court could look at the misconduct. What happened here, however, was these claims were the subject of a derivative demand by Mr. Notes a couple of years before the merger took about.
Right. What do we do with the, I don't know how much money is involved, but with this the due diligence expenses claim?
I don't think
the Wisconsin Supreme Court said it's not a derivative claim.
said it was not a derivative claim. It sent that back to the trial court, and the trial court dismissed that last week or last month. Said that Mr. Notes did not prove that there were any due diligence expenses actually incurred.
Was that on after a trial or summary judgment?
Summary judgment, actually, and also the circuit court dismissed the dissolution claim that the Wisconsin Supreme Court had said survived the merger on the basis of no proof of misconduct giving rise to dissolution.
Would it be possible for us to get that information into our record?
I would be happy to submit it, Your Honor. I wasn't sure whether that was 28J material, but I'll certainly give it in.
It's public judicial decisions are things that are, they're public. They're not contestable, so you can just send it under Rule 28J.
It just happened, and I apologize for not having done it sooner. What did Judge Clevert see when he went there? Now, our Supreme Court has said in the Einhorn versus Kalia case, our leading case on dissenters' rights, sort of like I think the Indiana, if I can refer to that statute that was present in the Shepard case, that once a derivative demand is made and a special litigation committee of independent directors has looked at it, if the SLC determines that this shouldn't be pursued, that's it. It takes it, as somebody said, it may have been in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, takes the question out of the courtroom and into the boardroom. It becomes a matter of business judgment. Now independent directors have looked back at the situation, and they've said, and the report is in the record, and Judge Clevert had it in front of him in the joint appendix at about page 100, they said, we would have done the same thing. Now we've looked at it. We've had the company valued by Duff and Phelps. We would have made the same decisions had we been independent directors. And they said, there is no evidence here of any malicious or wrongful conduct. We might have done the procedure a little bit better, and we wouldn't have had this fight. And therefore, they required ATS, or required the majority shareholder to make a payment to ATS, which, of course, Mr. Notes shared in at the time of dissolution. But there isn't anything wrong here. And Judge Clevert looks at that and said, I think, I came to try the value of a company. And you want me to try a case that you couldn't bring in state court, that you would be barred from bringing in state court. And I'm not going to do it. I don't think that's relevant. So while conceding that under different facts, if there had been, as in Cavalier, misconduct that occurred close to the date and that affected the value, an appraisal court could look at it, he just said, this isn't that case. HMOW itself was a case in which the allegation was basically of a bait and switch. The company had said, we think that the value of the company is $17 million. And then after dissenters had dissented and the merger had gone through, the company said, well, we've hired another appraiser, and he thinks it's only worth $7 million. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, trial judge can look into this and see whether or not he thinks there's anything wrong with that. The trial judge did, said that he didn't think there was anything wrong with it, and that judgment was affirmed. So, you know, this is it's a jurisdictional argument that I really don't think, you know, has merit. The argument that somehow M.S. Brayman has changed the rationale of all the Supreme Court's cases, Donald and Terrell and Wittens and Morris, I think it's an interesting argument, and it's one that I suppose Mr. Notes could ask the Supreme Court to take up, but it is not one, I think, open to this court. Precisely what this court said in the truck components case was that the state law cannot be construed to enlarge or contract federal jurisdiction. So it really does come down to a question of construction, and we know that it is a principle of Wisconsin statutory construction always to construe the statute in a way so as to avoid constitutional problems. So we respectfully submit that the judgment below should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.